from New York City, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null, broadcasting and, once again, video streaming live from our studios in New York City. And I'd like to welcome you. We have an extraordinarily power-packed information program today, the latest on health and healing, new information that we have explored the world's literature on what heals, what allows us to live a longer life from the best institutions. You'll hear about it in a few moments. And then we bring people to these airwaves that you have not heard on themes that are important but are generally not discussed, and if they are, not in an objective and honest way. Today, for example, we'll be hearing from Patrick Andendahl, talking about how did American democracy arrive at the doorstep of its demise? Are we seeing the final stages of democracy? And you can make up your mind once you hear what he has to say. Speaking about democracy and its failings and our leadership and their failings and what we should know, last evening on the Progressive Commentary Hour, I had one of the world's leading authorities on the House of Saud, the whole history of the Saud dynasty to an absolute monarchy backed by a powerful theocracy, Wahhabism, and what that portends for the future when you have a person who's only 32, who took control in a vicious coup, who confiscated nearly $800 billion, where it's reported, from his own relatives so that he could carry on his exploits around the world. And this is a person that the media praises or does not condemn, and we stop short of taking too close a look. For example, when he came to the United States, the media all lined up to have him on, as did members of Congress of both parties. And then they praised the idea that, yeah, he's a reformer. He allowed women a chance to drive. Well, yes and no. The 22 women who were responsible at great risk to themselves for asking for the right to drive instead of always being accompanied by a immediate male companion from their family relative, they were given limited ability to drive. But all 22 of those women were arrested. They're in prison. Not a word about this. No, he's not a reformer. And for a full hour, you hear the full truth and what's behind the opportunity to attack Iran. Why are they posturing to attack Iran, Israel, and the United States? So because of all of our people who do not have access to the internet, you'll be hearing that program in its entirety this Friday. So I want to make sure that you heard it, because we got a lot of very positive feedback from people, including a lot of people on this program who listen to this program who are scholars and academics and people who are used to in-depth information. They didn't know any of this. So I think you'll enjoy it. And also today, time permitting, a commentary from Chris Hedges on the nature of tyranny and how we're going there. I have several commentaries I've been writing, including one when I flew back to New York yesterday afternoon in a plane, where I was thinking about, yes, we do have the right to protest, but then we are targeted for our ability to protest and our right to protest. So what good is a right if it's not able to be exercised without fear? And that brings me to this issue. Right now, there is a cancer metastasizing on the soul of the original intent of pure educational systems to empower people to critical thought. And this is identity politics at its worst, its ugliest. And we're going to continue to bring this to your attention. And part of that will be today with a segment from Brett Weinstein testifying before Congress under oath on the Evergreen State College riots and free speech and safe spaces and what it means. Because when we maladapt to any system, we become that maladaptation until one day we wake up and think it's completely normal how far we've gone in the opposite direction of what we should be. So that's what we have planned today. You can watch today's show by going to Progressive Radio Network and to our Facebook page. And you can download this video if you can't watch it. Now you can watch it later. And also, a lot of people, 99% of the people who communicate with us do so generally in the evenings and some on the weekends. I received an email from a very famous person, I won't mention him, who says that every weekend he and his wife go up to their home in Connecticut and they take a week's worth of programs so that they have enough to listen up and enough to listen back, and they learn a lot that way. So if you can only listen on the archives, here is the number to call. You'll call this number, 701-719-9976. Again, 701-719-9976. Let's begin with health and healing as we do every day. This is from Johns Hopkins School of Public Health. And it is about essential oils. Now, you know, one group says, oh, essential oils don't mean anything. There's nothing to them. That's not true. Essential oils have phenomenal healing power. In fact, think of all the people right now in what is called flu season, but flu can occur any time during a year. But this is when our immune system is challenged by weather fluctuations, being too much in controlled heat, high heat, which is not good for us, and then going out into the cold. In any case, they found that oils from garlic and other herbs kill persistent Lyme disease bacteria. Now, when you consider the Northeast, New York, Pennsylvania, Connecticut, New Jersey, New Hampshire, Massachusetts, the Outer Ondex area, the Casco area, this is ground zero for Lyme's disease. Every person I know who owns a farm or a home where there's any woods has been affected by ticks and, in many cases, Lyme's disease. And they've tried many things, including antibiotics. Here's the downside. You take the antibiotics, it can kill certain bacteria, but it doesn't get rid of Lyme's disease, but it does destroy your immune system. Whereas when you're using oils from garlic and several other common herbs and medicinal plants, they show strong activity against the bacterium that causes Lyme's disease. Now, according to the study by researchers at Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health, these oils are especially useful in alleviating Lyme symptoms that persist despite standard antibiotic treatment. The study also suggests that there's a lot more that they need to do in research, but there's a lot there. And this was published in the peer-reviewed journal Antibiotics. And there were 35 essential oils that were pressed from plants to their, or their fruits and contain the plant's main fragrance or essence, hence essential oil. And cinnamon, allspice, clove, myrrh, thyme, garlic, and cumin had the strongest activity for slowing down or killing the Lyme's disease bacterium. Now, the Mediterranean diet during pregnancy is associated with a lower risk of accelerated growth of any disease later. So that's very important that we understand that. So a healthy diet pattern has been associated with lower obesity and cardiovascular risk in adults. So if you have a mother that has a healthy plant-based diet and has a healthy offspring, you're more likely not to have or be at lower risk of obesity and cardiovascular and metabolic disorders like diabetes as you age. And that's a new study published in the Journal of Pediatrics. And it evaluated the association between the adherence to a Mediterranean diet during pregnancy with growth patterns and cardiometabolic risk in early infancy. Why is this important? Because we have an epidemic today in adult diabetes in infants, toddlers, and children. When I grew up, we only knew of one kid that was obese in school. Just one. And today, it's about 70%. And well, does that mean a bad outcome later in life? You bet. Also, they found that chemicals in personal care products and household products are linked to earlier puberty in girls. And this is from the University of California, Berkeley. And we're talking about products that people use all the time. What you don't want is you don't want a young girl entering puberty too early. That can cause all forms of problems for them, including earlier opportunity for cancers. The study published in Human Reproduction, one of the world's leading reproductive medical journals, found that chemicals like phthalates and parabens and phenols were all associated with earlier puberty in girls. And that is not good. So perfumes, deodorants, soaps, shampoos, nail polish, cosmetics. Parabens are often used as preservative in cosmetics and personal care products. Phenols, which include triclosan, is used in soaps and toothpastes and lipsticks and hairsprays and shampoos and skin lotions. So not good. And let us also realize that an awful lot of young teenagers in particular, let's say 12 years to 14 years, become phobic on their body, not all, but a lot, and they start going on a lot of these fad diets and they starve themselves. That's where bulimia and anorexia are frequently manifest. If we have young women who use examples of other young women who are very healthy, but healthy without starving, healthy without purging and binging and purging, healthy without thinking badly about their bodies, that shouldn't start once they're at 14. That should start in early life where people are not body shamed, where people are allowed to realize that our bodies are unique to us. If you took a look at people's eyes, many people's eyelids are not the same. They have what's called a drooping eye. A lot of very famous actors and actresses have their eyelids digitally corrected so that in a movie you won't notice that. They can have spider veins. They can have a crepey skin, which is like a saggy, foldy skin, all tightened up. And it costs them millions of dollars per film, but that's what they want. That's what they get. So imagine then with our focus upon beauty at any cost and by any measure, and looking at the Kardashians as an example. Well, I'd like to think they're probably the worst example of what human beings should represent towards other human beings. They are vacuous. They're intellectually incompetent. There's no spiritual, emotional balancing within anything they share. It's just money, narcissism. Money, fame, narcissism. Money, fame, celebrity access, narcissism. Until one day we think it's completely normal that these people are there to, you know, guide the way. They're not there to guide the way for any of us. So we have to look for better examples, and it should start in school, and it should start with our parents at home and then school teachers. It should be in the curriculum to examine the bodies, to have classes on what the bodies should be like, how they develop, how we're each different and unique, instead of thinking, well, there's only one perfection, and if I don't meet that perfection, I'm going to feel bad about myself, and then I'm going to do foolish things. Now you have corrective surgery in people as young as 8 and 10 years of age. That's foolish. That's dangerous. It's not right, because then they're not going to be happy about whatever they are the rest of their life. And imagine when they go from 40 up and suddenly everything that they had taken for granted before then starts to change. I have a friend of mine who says that he's depressed every day when he takes a shower and looks in the mirror. I say, why? He says, because my body's not the same. I said, of course it's not. I said, but what are you doing to make it look better? We're all aging. None of us get out of life alive. But the quality of the life we live each day is determined upon the choices we make. Are you exercising every day? Are you taking enough protein in every day from plant sources? That helps keep you younger with more muscle mass longer. Are you taking the branched chain amino acids? Are you taking creatine monohydrate? Are you taking D-ribose? That allows you more energy throughout the day, including brain energy, more energy for the cells to exercise, and your body muscle mass actually stabilizes. Are you doing that? Well, no. So what do you think is going to happen? Your muscles are going to turn to fat. You're going to develop men boobs. You're going to have your whole body is going to start to fall apart. Your skin will sag, and you could reverse that. You could take things that stimulate the natural human growth hormone. Exercise does, but you got to do it every day. You have to eat right every day. You can't be episodic and be healthy. Also, from Yale University, stress eats a hole in your brain. Whoa, really? Yeah. Here's how it happens and what to do about it. According to the latest medical research on this, and this was a Yale University study, stress caused the brain to shrink. So next time you're stressed, and really stressed, and you can't focus, and you can't think or remember the ingredients that you just made in a meal, and you can't remember what you just read, you can legitimately blame stress for part of that. And it's because, according to the neuroscience involved in this, stress is an underpinned but particular hormone series that circulate through the body and the brain. And those stress hormones are very bad for brain tissue. They eat away at brain tissue. I repeat that. Stress, cortisol, causes an eating away of your brain tissue. And so a result is you end up getting these miniature holes in your brain. Literally, stress chews away at your brain. So you keep that in mind. And finally, chlorella. C-H-L-O-R-E-L-L-A, chlorella. It's a powerful medicinal plant that can prevent inflammation-related diseases. Now, that's according to the latest research at the ETAP lab and in France. And researchers in France have found that chlorella can reduce inflammation and prevent inflammation-related diseases. And that's important because what are some, you know, for example, I've seen in my own practice that chlorella has an impact upon visceral pain and associated inflammatory parameters like cystitis, inflammation of the bladder. And cystitis is very common. But how about fibromyalgia, inflammation and pain in your muscles? How about arthritis in your joints? How about lower back pain? Well, chlorella can make a difference in all of these. It's almost pure chlorophyll. It's very high in proteins. So the moment you have a health drink and you put a scoop of chlorella powder in it, you've just given your body a lot of really good nutrition. And that's important. One more. The omega-3 fatty acids, which we should all be consuming every day, suppress allergic conjunctivitis, and that's according to the Genito University in Japan. And this was published in the FASEB Scientific Journal, and it showed that a diet based on omega-3 fatty acids alleviates the conjunctivitis, and especially allergic conjunctivitis. And so that could help with the treatments of diseases not based on traditional mast cell stabilizer and antihistamine eye drops. So anytime you have inflammation, you have histamines. Anytime you have histamines, you're going to have, let's say a high level of inflammatory response, swelling, localized pain. So there are nutrients that can help lower histamine levels, and the omega-3 fatty acids do that. And by the way, Penn State University found that a toxin that travels from stomach to brain can trigger Parkinson's. Yeah. Combining low doses of a toxic herbicide with sugar-binding proteins called lectins can trigger Parkinson's. Symptoms typical of Parkinson's disease, like body tremors and slowing of body motions. Just, you know, we have to know these things. if we're to do something about them. That's the latest on Health and Healing. I'm Gary Knoll, back in studio New York for a short period of time, finishing up with my editors today and tomorrow for the next several days, all the films that I've been on the road filming, and we've been filming everywhere. When you see our new film, which we hope to premiere in the next 3 months, you will see film from every part of the planet, from the glaciers of South America that are gone to the glaciers in Glacier National Park, and we'll show you in a timeline how much that we've lost in the last 50 years, to the Sahara Desert and the desertification of countries, to the toxic waters at the top, middle, and bottom of the Ganges and the other great rivers of the world. So that's important, and we're going to share all that with you. But now I have to sit, and with a team headed by Valerie Van Cleave, we will put it all together. But we have two other documentaries we're putting together at the same time. So it's been a very busy time, and later this week, on Friday, I'll be announcing a new book that'll be available as of Friday. A long time in the making, but I have two new books that are coming off press this week. So a lot's happening. A lot of good things are happening. Oh, and by the way, if any of you are not familiar with Adlai, T-A-D-L-A-Y, it's being used to prevent influenza. This is from the Magawa Women's University in Japan. Now, we know that influenza, what you would call the flu, can be treated with Adlai tea. That's according to a study published in the Journal of Science of Food and Agriculture, offering a novel means to treat the disease without having to depend upon chemical medication. So it's just very strong in its antiviral properties. Adlai, A-D-L-A-Y, can inhibit the influenza virus, and that's important. So all this is good. We want to always give you stuff that no one else has. Back in a moment with a commentary. Please stay with us.
Try to remember when we didn't have no shoes. We stuck together, just me and you. It took a long time to get what we got today. Now you want to give it all up for another guy.
Nice to have you with us, everyone. I'm Gary Knoll. I'm concerned, I believe we should all be concerned, about neoliberalism's dark path to fascism. Chris Hedges is particularly concerned. And, oh, by the way, I want to mention Abby Martin has a program on Progressive Radio Network, and Jimmy Dore's coming up, and the Corbett Report, James Corbett. So we are pulling together the finest investigative journalist minds in the country. And they'll be showing a series of Chris Hedges' films. It doesn't matter, quite frankly, whether you are a Democrat or Republican today, because both of your systems have been co-opted by the elite group behind the scenes. They, in turn, have mastered the art of neoliberalism as economic theory, and it was always an absurdity. It has as much validity as past ruling ideologies such as the divine right of kings or fascism's belief in they have the right of total power. None of its vaunted promises were even remotely possible. Concentrating wealth in the hands of a global oligarchical elite, mainly eight families, now hold as much as 50% of the world's population while demolishing government controls and regulations always creates massive income inequality and monopoly power, and it fuels political extremism and destroys democracy. You do not need to slog through a long read from hundreds of different books on the dangers of vulture capitalism, predatory capitalism. Now, there is capitalism that's of an ethical base. I mentioned this over 30 years ago. Conscious capitalism, I called it, where you make money, you have a right to earn a living in whatever way you choose, providing that you're doing it without it costing someone else something. In other words, you cannot profit at someone else's loss. That's vulture capitalism. That's predatory capitalism. That is the dominant capitalism for those in power. That's not all capitalism. We have only looked at the capitalism in the two extremes of the country, the East Coast and the West Coast. We've looked at Silicon Valley, highly predatory, with robotics, with artificial intelligence, with transhumanism, the next thing coming. And it has been sold to us as a way of helping us. Well, in some ways it does. If we had an opportunity to know what was going on in a person's brain, and we thought they might have had microstroke, but we couldn't see it. But if artificial intelligence as technology could show us yes or no, there was a stroke, here's where it was at, that would be beneficial. That's the problem. The benefit of these new technologies only shows us the positive side, never the downside. Could you just imagine people creating right now as we speak technologies that no longer have to be programmed? They're able to program themselves. How likely are they then, when they can program themselves and all internets are interconnected in the world, that they could do anything they wanted to any internet system, any electronic system, any nuclear power system, any airline control system, any train control system, any phone system, any heat system, electrical system on the planet? And you believe that that is good capitalism? No. No, that is neo-capitalism at its worst. Ethical capitalism allows people to profit, allows people to have their experiences as they chose, but also there is a large safety net that is created because of that, where they combine the best of ethical capitalism with the best of needed social programs, public education, universal health care, the public parks, affordable housing, a good but responsible localized police force coming from the community, where an officer is not dressed in military gear, but rather is walking the beat and lives in the very neighborhood they're walking. That's what it used to be. That's what it should be. But again, you have to have ethics, and you have to look at a larger picture, and you have to look at how what you're doing and suggesting would impact other people to see whether or not it's reasonable. Now, something can be reasonable and feasible, but it doesn't mean that it is acceptable to those in power. So these small groups of families decide for themselves that they want what they want. And everything in their life is an economic rationality. The point of people wanting to have their own unique power class and make it a ruling ideology is the basis of neoliberalism. And that's what they considered their brilliant success. And it started really in the 1970s. Its Keynesian mainstream critics were pushed out of academia. State institutions and financial organizations such as the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank, and shut out of the media. And compliant courtiers and intellectual posers such as Milton Friedman were groomed in places such as University of Chicago and given prominent platforms and lavish corporate funding. They disseminated the official mantra of fringe, discredited economic theories popularized by Friedrich Hayek and the third-rate writer Ayn Rand. And by the way, later on, not today, I don't have time, I'll tell you a story about myself and Ayn Rand and her male friend at the time, someone who espoused, you know, you're in it for yourself and don't worry about other people. Boy, in the latter stages of her life, she needed other people to intervene on her behalf. Then she got to see what it was like to be the rest of us. Well, once we knelt before the dictates of the marketplace and lifted government regulations and slashed taxes for the rich and permitted the flow of money across borders and destroyed unions and signed trade deals that sent jobs to sweatshops in China and India, the world would be a happier, freer, wealthier place. We were told it was all a con job, all of it. But it worked. It's important to recognize the class origins of this project, which occurred in the 1970s. Now, you've heard me mention many times that our capitalist class caused the outsourcing of somewhere between 20 to 30 million jobs. I saw it at the time. I spoke about it on the air at the time. I railed about it, but no one cared because those people who tell us what is best for us were absolutely certain that the new corporations, which were merging and buying other corporations and saddling them with unspeakably large financial service debt, only wanted the power. When you look at a Macy's that was purchased by Federated, you look at all the thousands of corporations that were well run. They were profitable. They had little or no debt. And then look at why. The truth, why the vast majority of these once very important corporations went bankrupt is because they've been previously purchased by someone else. Right now, we're seeing JCPenney and Target and these other corporations that were bought by equity partners, you know, the kind like Bain Capital that Mitt Romney ran, and nobody on the right was willing to challenge him on his utter lack of morality. If he made his hundreds of millions of dollars off the backs of people who were just regular working class people, he didn't care. And Toys R Us, same thing. Almost every single major bankruptcy or closing down of a major corporation caused because of vulture capitalism. And nobody wanted to hear about it because those vultures were also amassing the largest personal fortunes in American history, actually dwarfing the Rockefellers, the Carnegies, the Goulds, the Swearingens, the Hills. They had more money. And they made it in a shorter period of time. And there was no ethics how they made it. At least the de' Medici family, when it was under Lorenzo, he would sit with one of the world's greatest living philosophers and a person who knew about all the previous philosophy over the previous 800 or so years, and talk about how should the money be made and how should the money be spent and how they should build things for the betterment of society, not just themselves. And that began the Renaissance, 300 years from 1500 to, oh, a little earlier, about 1400 to around 1700, the greatest monuments that we all can enjoy today, from the gardens to the arts, from operas and plays and poetry, Shakespeare, all these people were supported by them. Do you see any of that today? You don't see any of that today. It's all about oneself, what one has the money to do that they can buy. These are the neoliberals. These are the elite. These are the people who also want to meddle in politics. They're politically illiterate. They're culturally illiterate. I won't mention her name, but one of my friends from high school became a major curator at the Museum of Modern Art and told me in a conversation that we were talking about. I said there was a time when the people who were associated with the museums had a deep understanding of culture and ethics, etiquette, and social understanding, knowing the society they were living in. Oh, yeah, not now. Whoever can write the $100 million check or donate a big painting, that's who sits on the board. That's our society. Well, these people profited of the people's loss. They don't care about who loses. If nature loses, animals lose, humans lose, another class lose, another race lose. They don't care. It's irrelevant to them. All we have now are people who want to get into the ruling class and are angry because they're not yet there, because the bar keeps being raised. Used to be if you had $1 million, boy, you were rich. Today, If you're 70 years of age, you will need $3 million to live out the rest of your life with some quality of life, and not excessive, just quality of life, $3 million. Do you know how much it costs to raise a kid, taking him through college today? Over $1 million. So $1 million doesn't mean a lot. It means a lot if you don't have it. But now those people who have $5 million want 20. Those who have 100 want 500. Those who want a 500 want to be a billionaire. Billionaires have their own exclusion class. Unless you've got at least $5 billion, you're chump change. Do you see how all this is artificial? None of it's real. It doesn't help anybody. These people are not using their money and their power to make it a better world, to eliminate poverty, hunger, abuse, wars. They profit from it. That is the need for the new ruling ideals. So the ruling ideas were that freedom of the market, privatization, entrepreneurialism of the self, individual liberty, and all the rest of it should be the ruling ideas of the new social order, and that was the order that got implemented in the 1980s and 90s. That is what has become politicized. So where I support freedom of choice, you bet, and liberty and freedom and constitutional truths, you bet. These people just cared about the freedom of the markets to be exploited. But what happens when the hypocrisy, and I just want to call them out, the utter complete hypocrisy of all these one-grained intellects on television talking about the economy. You talk about the freedom of the market. You talk about the power of the market. You talk about the private market solving the problems. They create problems. Who made the bombs that were used for the last 35 years in all the conflict areas, leaving depleted uranium? The private market, without any concern that they were leaving thousands a year legacy. Who created the nuclear power plants and created fission where those spent fuel rods could never be safely dealt with? For thousands of years, they would be toxic. The private market. Who created the vaccines and then made them mandatory when there is no good science proving that they are effective and safe for any given child? The free market. Who created now an unlimited amount of those? The free market. I see. Who privatizes at one time, like parking spaces or a highway? So now you have to stop every few miles and pay again a toll. The private marketplace. Who makes money off money and not by building new factories? They don't want to invest in something that could actually fail. Wall Street. Who gets bailed out? Wall Street. Who gets $21 trillion in bailouts? Wall Street. How much does the average person get? Nothing. How about the small business person? Nothing. So neoliberalism only cares about those people who are, in the end, too incompetent, too unprofessional, too insensitive, tone deaf to what people actually need and do it right to own and run a profitable business. I'm talking about General Motors, General Electric. I'm talking about Ford. I'm talking about Chrysler. I'm talking about every single major bank, all run by idiots. Greedy, despicable idiots. And yet, we're supposed to believe that let the titans of industry have no impediment to making even more money. Okay. They've hired the politicians, paid for them, vassals of private obedience, but not public service, to do their bidding. So they got bailed out. So laissez-faire, you do not have. Capitalism, you do not have. You have socialism for all the major corporations in Wall Street and the need for socialism in the military-industrial complex and the medical-industrial complex and the energy-industrial complex. All of that is based upon socialism. Isn't that the irony? Think of that for a moment. Wrap your brain around that just for a moment. Without we the people, without the poorest of us, the middle class and the upper middle class, paying for their mistakes and their incompetency, their greed and their hubris, they would fail. But we don't allow incompetence to fail. We put them in the White House. We put them in Senate. We put them in governorships. We put them as district attorneys. Greedy little bastards they are. We put the worst human people in positions of power because on their own, they would fail miserably and they'd be called out. Like if you and I try something, we fail, we're told, Well, you made a mistake. Yeah, learn from it. Start over. When they fail, no. Got to give them TARP. Got to give them bailouts. Got to give them subsidies. Got to give them every kind of tax advantage. Got to give them, really? If they're so smart, why don't they stick with pure capitalism? All because pure capitalism doesn't exist and hasn't. That's the truth of it. Social capitalism does. They are subsidizing their losses, but they privatize their profits and gains. Think on that. Back in a moment with my guest. Please stay with us. I'd like to welcome my guest onto the program now. He is Patrick Adendall. That's A-N-D-E-N-D-A-L-L. He's an award-winning British investigative journalist, author, and he has dealt with a lot of issues that are not getting the type of input that I believe that they deserve. His latest book is Who is Jeb? Takes a political and satirical romp through the Bush family's legacy of incompetence. His website is stupidpartyland.com. Nice to have you with us today, Patrick.
Good afternoon. Just a quick correction. My latest book is actually called Deliverance. I did Jeb Bush a year ago, so whatever. But so my third book is Deliverance from Stupid Party Land.
Oh, okay.
Which just came out the other day.
We look forward to that. I'm reminded that with the advent of the internet, the entire developed world was promised that it would make citizens better educated and more informed about society and the world. It was believed that this would also strengthen democracy and benefit critical thinking for making informed decisions, especially within the political voting process. However, the results, at least from my perspective, have been quite the opposite. Not only has the internet been hijacked by much of the tyrannical corporate and political elite, Americans in particular are getting dumber and turning more gullible by the day, including people who thought that they were well-educated. But in my opinion, they're not. They're better programmed. They're better controlled for what we call newspeak in this fictitious totalitarian country. You know, what was it, Oceania in 1984. But the problem is more malignant and insipid, then that's because everything now is upside down that the mainstream media dishes out. I'm reminded of the scene from the film A Few Good Men when Jack Nicholson bursts out, "You can't handle the truth." And perhaps the American public and even all of our leaders of major corporations and the government who are products of this culture are simply too stupid to handle the truth. But it took many years and decades for the United States to reach this impasse. So what do you contribute as the main causes for the downward spiraling trend into this stupid land? The forum is yours.
Well, I slightly disagree with your conclusions. I mean, clearly people are getting, the critical thinking is under attack. I'm not totally convinced. I mean, most of the ignorance today is not necessarily coming as a result of, as you describe it, mainstream media. I think if you're trying to check facts and trying to do research, you still rely on the same sort of names, you know, the Forbes and the BBCs and the New York Times and all the rest. And when you're looking at the sort of massive levels of ignorance, especially amongst Republican voters, 67% of them really are totally incapable of digesting facts. That's coming from the new media, the alt-right media. It's coming from the explosion of the social media, which so far, because there's no immunity that we've built up to this new explosion of clickbait news and everything, anything sort of becoming believable, the ability of foreign agents and powers to manipulate how we think, all of that has really happened fairly rapidly in the last decade or so, or a bit longer. And again, I don't think people have built up an immunity, and we probably need new courses at college or in the general forum about how do you fact check. You know, if you hear a fact that's too much in line and sounds too good, well, maybe you should just see where's it coming from. And it's coming from two or three sources, or a quote from somebody is coming from two or three reputable sources. I mean, you may not like the mainstream media, but they still have journalistic standards. They still have to fact check. They can't lie. So it's still a bulwark against everything else that's gone wrong. And if, when you're really asking, again, specifically why the Republican Party just is so, you know, based upon myth rather than math, which my first book was about, I'm not sure if I really want to go down the road of blaming mainstream media. Now, on the other hand, I also recognize when we talk about this country being left or right, I regard the whole country as right. If you take the most left-leaning senator, who most people would say it's Bernie Sanders, to me, he's a pretty standard guy. And none of his views, with the possible exception of university free university for everybody, which, you know, we can debate backwards and forwards, but not none of his other views are remotely controversial in any other country. And yet he's considered an outlier. So it's like, yes, the country's extremely right-wing, and yes, mainstream media, because it's run by corporations and journalists are paid by those people, they are leading relatively comfortable lives, and nobody's reflecting the needs of what I call the struggling class. And in America, you don't use the term working class, you use the term middle class. Everybody, in my mind, like everybody except for the top 5% or 1%, is in the middle class, i.e. the struggling class does not get a voice.
Okay, I appreciate your insights. Thank you. I would share this perspective. We took our time and we started to look at all the statistics in the United States. And we found that it's not 1% or 2% that control. There's a very powerful group, and it's 0.01% that have enormous wealth. And there's 127 companies that control over 40% of all the world's resources. But in the United States, and we're about to be overtaken by both China and India, we have had historically the largest professional class. And I'm referring to from school teachers to academics, lawyers, doctors, engineers, professors, consultants, business managers, people who have more of an advanced education and are considered a careerist. There's a total of 71 million. When you add in their families, you're up to over 181 million, over half the American population. And that creates these unique situations where you have booming real estate markets in New York and Los Angeles, San Francisco, Miami. And at the same time, the average, what you would call working class person, cannot afford to even rent there. And that's why I believe that we should be having more of a migration into the middle of the country where you can have a better quality of life at a substantially less price. But when we look at the statistics, the best and worst, I'll give one example, public educational systems in the United States, what we consistently discover is the reddest states, which happen to be the most religious also, are at the bottom. And blue states and states that have stronger histories of liberal values and social rights are at the top. For example, statistics show that Vermont is about 500% smarter and better informed than the population of Mississippi. Now, how do you account for this enormous divide? And what role do you believe religion, especially evangelical Christianity, is just one example. I'm only taking one piece of this puzzle to ask you about, is playing in the dumbing down of Americans who wholeheartedly embrace the Republican Party, or we'll start with that.
First, I'll just get that you're quoting right from a graph of mine when you mentioned Mississippi and Vermont. I actually did some math taking, I think, oh, I don't want to exaggerate, maybe 20 different issues ranging from quality of life to education to obesity to how much porn you have or whatever it is. And you rate each state from 0 to 50, you know, 1 being the best, 50 being the bottom. And then I came up with some sort of average for everything. And sure enough, you pegged it. Mississippi came in bottom, shortly followed by places like Alabama and all the rest. Number one would have been Vermont, and two, Massachusetts, on using 20 different things. And you're right. And another thing, especially in the first book, you know, especially every single quality of life type issue, educational type issue, red states dominate the bottom and blue states dominate the top. And getting to this whole issue, you know, I know your narrative, I understand your narrative, I heard your introduction and all the rest. It's important you understand that as an author and as my public persona, I pitch my flag right in the middle as a standard capitalist, as an orthodox capitalist, and that allows me to argue without sort of bringing in any baggage of any sort of philosophy other than I'm staking my stake right there in the middle. And when it comes to taxation and issues, I don't propose any tax policies at all except on one rule of thumb. Every tax policy should be based on one thing only. And I've looked at, you look at income discrepancy trends, and I know you have, and you fully understand what I'm going to say. I have no problem with income discrepancy. It's income discrepancy trends that are the concern. If you look at what's happened for the last 30 or 40 years, and then you try and promulgate that forward for the next 30 years, what happens? Well, clearly, you obviously have an oligarchy. I'm sure you don't disagree with that. And if you carry on, what's the next step from an oligarchy? And that should be fairly obvious to anybody who can just have any sort of vision in the future. So what I say is any tax policy must be judged by what it does to mitigate income discrepancy trends. So, for instance, like you just had the tax cuts for the wealthy recently. Forget whether you agree with that or not. The question is, was that the best tax cut to stimulate the economy, assuming you wanted to stimulate the economy, which is highly questionable right now? And therefore, you know, another thing I did was I compared trickle-down economics, which is supply-side economics, which is discredited economics, which is what the tax plan was we just had, and you compare that with what I call trickle-up economics. And most economists would argue that trickle-up would be 250%, say, more stimulative to the economy, i.e. 250% more successful in what you're trying to achieve. But I say that all those economists get it wrong because the way they do it, they divide the top 50 from the bottom 50, and that's how they come up with their calculations. And I'm saying that's not the American problem. The American problem is not the 50 against 50. It's the top 1% against the 99, or as you would say, the 0.001% against the rest. And if you did it for this top 1% or the top 5% and then compared what happens to the economy, trickle up, if you help the bottom 20%, actually is 700% more stimulative to the economy. So obviously, trickle up, if it's would work far more effectively. And the thing is, if you're a capitalist, why wouldn't you want that? Because you're growing your customer base. You have customers who can afford to buy your products. So being trickled down is very myopic.
I agree, but there's more people today investing in debt than ever before in our history. And we've got to return to the debtors' prisons. We have private prisons. People, 80,000 SWAT team raids last year, the majority were for people not paying debt. So we have abused this whole economic principle. I told you, if you heard everyone in this audience, that I believe in ethical capitalism, where I can earn a living without it costing someone else. Today's capitalism is predicated upon how much people can make for their corporations, their stockholders, and themselves, but they don't think of the consequences. And I had suggested that instead of giving a tax break, which is about $1.3 trillion to the rich that ended up buying back their own stock, their own treasury stock, which increased the value of their price per share, that instead put that into the hands as free loans for the first 2 years, then a 1% interest, providing that for every $1 million you give to a small business person in the United States, they have to hire two employees at a living wage, not a minimum wage, which brings money back into the local economy, stimulates new businesses, stimulates things that people want at the local level, and therefore solidifies a stronger economy, much like what we had in the late 40s, 50s, 60s, and early 70s. But of course, no one's interested in that. And just my thought. Last question for you. For years, we have called the era we live in now a postmodern society, which basically means that absolute truth has been debunked and all truths are relative. But there are still elements of truth upon which we make informed decisions. And now we hear the term post-truth being used increasingly, especially during the past 2 years since Trump took office. What should we be thinking about? What does it mean to us if we're now living in a post-truth society?
Well, obviously, this is why I wrote my third book, which is Deliverance from Stupid Party Land, How to Eradicate the Destructive Forces Destroying American Democracy. And if you look at the trends, they're not promising at all, because forget the Trump cycle, which is particularly egregious, which there will probably be some sort of pushback against that at some point, which happened in the midterm elections, and people might get a bit complacent. But the point is, the trends are not good, and they're only getting it, and therefore a slide away from democracy into oligarchy and into maybe a form of fascism is almost mathematically inevitable. Now you ask yourself, can the American voter get up from its basic complacency and reverse that trend? I'm not totally convinced that they can. Therefore, you know, that's why I write about a different solution that might start becoming apparent in about 5 or 6 years' time. And that does talk about really wealthy people and all the rest. And I know in the introduction I heard before how you were castigating, you know, all wealthy people. I don't quite see it that way.
Not all wealthy people. No. If that's the impression I made, it was not intended. Yeah. I never castigate all wealthy people. I castigate and challenge all people who support neoliberalism and do not consider the consequences of how they made their money or the consequences of what those are. And that's why I use the example of the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund saddling nations with so much debt that never benefited the people living there, and the privatization of commons that we now are burdened with. That's the ones that I challenge.
And, you know, and I obviously agree with all of that. And I just pointed a very negative view, and I wanted to counterpoint that, you know, that can the American voter, can it get away from its complacency and its growing sort of fury and its inability to get its views across in the present political environment, which is obviously, you know, money has basically bought up democracy. And so just to give you a hint of some good news, which may eventually materialize at some point, which is what I talk about mathematically, if you look at the breakdown of wealthy people in 1985 and compare how that compares today and how if you promulgate that forward to 2025, you're going to see a vast difference of the type of people who are really wealthy. Now, a lot of these benign oligarchs right now, if you take a Bill Gates and Warren Buffett and people like that, they're not trying to help America because America doesn't want to be helped. They see they get a far, and you're talking about dealing with poverty and all the rest. Well, you know, the Bill Gates Foundation and all the rest actually is being very effective in dealing with health issues and poverty issues outside of the United States, and because those are people who want to be helped. The red states in this country are still mostly basically want to keep cutting their own throats, so why would Bill Gates and people like that try and help them out? It's just not going to be a good value proposition. So I guess the hopeful sign is that at some point I see a power shift going on between what I call the malignant oligarchs and the benign oligarchs, and if at some point they might be able to intervene at some stage. Right now, obviously not, because the Americans aren't ready for it. They're not calling for it. They don't want it.
Okay. Well, that is something that we will take on in a longer program. I'm going to invite you back to our Progressive Commentary Hour for a full hour on this. I'm Gary Noll. We're out of time. Thank you all for listening. Have a nice day.